But I think we can look forward to our talk today. Forrest MacDonald is always controversial, always very stimulating in the types of presentations that he gives. In fact, he is criticized in his book that's come out recently, historians who write very boring and very dull, very dry works, and he footnotes himself as a very living illustration and example of this. This, of course, was in his younger age, and today he will be speaking to us on the King Hog, cultural conservatism, and the antebellum South. Forrest?
Current MacDonalds, of course, do not carry old grudges, but I would recommend that, inasmuch as we have a camel for a host, we keep the doors at least unlocked. We've heard a great deal about Southerners and their virtues and their characters and the wickedness of the Yankees, and I'm going to presume today, having informed you last time I had the privilege of speaking before the Philadelphia Society of that greatest of all Celts of all times, Alexander Hamilton, and how you can get from Alexander to Hamilton to what I'm about to talk about now is a long story which I won't tell you. But I'm going to presume today to attempt to explain to you how the Southerner got to be what he was. Of all the comments made by contemporary observers of the antebellum South, the most nearly universal was that Southerners loved their leisure, or, as hostile observers put it, they were lazy. The climate and external appearance of the country conspire to make them indolent, easy, and good-natured, wrote Andrew Burnaby in 1759. They seldom show any spirit of enterprise or expose themselves willingly to fatigue. They are content if they can live from day to day. Later in the 18th century, Charles Wood Mason described backcountry Southerners as ignorant and, quote, very poor owing to their extreme indolence. They delight in their present low, lazy, sluttish, heathenish, hellish life and seem not desirous of changing it. Both men and women will do anything to come at liquor, clothes, furniture, etc., rather than work for it. In 1810, Charles J. Ingersoll, like many another observer, attributed the constitutional indolence of Southerners to the institution of slavery. Man will not labor, he claimed, where he can substitute slaves. But indolence was not confined to slave owners. Among the lower classes of Southern society, Henry C. Knight reported in 1824, the Canaan richness of the land is productive, among better fruits, of much indolence. Too many, instead of resting on one day in seven, work only on one day in six, and therefore ever remain poor. Southerners of all social classes would have rejected the naive and culture-bound assumption that people naturally seek to better their condition. In the 1830s, Charles F. Hoffman attempted to convince a Southerner of, quote, the superiority which greater industry and acquired knowledge of useful facts gives the Northern man. The Southerner replied that if the people did not live up to other people's ideas, they lived as well as they wanted to. They didn't want to make slaves of themselves. They were contented with living as their fathers had lived before them. And as Frederick Law Olmsted pointed out in the 1850s, the Southerner has no pleasure in labor. He enjoys life itself. He is content with being. Here is the grand distinction between him and the Northerner. For the Northerner enjoys progress in itself. He finds his happiness in doing. Rest in itself is irksome and offensive to him. Such impressionistic observations may be cited endlessly. They may also be borne out by some rough calculations. In a paper delivered before the Organization of American Historians last spring, my colleague Grady McWinney and I employed the techniques of the cleometricians to arrive at an estimate of how much antebellum Southerners had to work to produce everything they did produce. We found that if we assumed that no white ever lifted a finger, and that only half the slaves worked in the fields, it would have taken about 1,400 hours a year, or 140 10-hour days, to produce and harvest all the cotton and the corn, which was 95% of the production, all the cotton and all the corn raised in Mississippi and Alabama during the 1850s. If we assume that whites did all the work involved in raising this lower South's second largest crop, namely corn, the per capita workload for whites was 27 hours per year. In other words, contemporary observers were right when they reported that most antebellum Southerners were contemptuous of work and did as little of it as possible. The reporters were wrong, however, when they declared that, as a result, Southerners were poor. Obviously, the planters were well off. As for the slaves, though there has been quibbling about the exploitation rate, you know, Fogel and Ingerman calculated that the slaves got to keep something like 93% of the output of their labors or something in that order, and some people being outraged have now calculated it's only 67% or 70%. But that's a pretty high proportion. Anyway, as for the slaves, though there has been quibbling about the exploitation rate, it is now conceded that the material well-being of the slaves was at least close to being on a par with that of free northern farmers, and far better than that of agricultural laborers any place else in the world. But what of those leisurely southern white plain folk, who, after all, constituted about four-fifths of the white population? Superficially, they did seem to have been impoverished, at least in comparison with their hard-working Yankee brethren, for they tended to live in squalor. Olmsted, in a typical passage that can be found with variations in the accounts of numerous other travelers, wrote of an East Texas house that, quote, was more comfortless than nine-tenths of the stables of the North. There were several windows, some of which were boarded over, some had wooden shutters, and some were entirely open. There was not a pane of glass. The doors were closed with difficulty. We could see the stars as we lay in bed, through the openings in the roof, and on all sides, in the walls of the room, one's arm might be thrust out. It was 31 degrees that night, too. That description sounds for all the world like the direst poverty. I can imagine Michael Harrington discovering the antebellum South and just going into rhapsodic ecstasies of joy. And it is an entirely characteristic representation of the appearance of most antebellum Southern homes. But appearances were deceptive. That farmer, the one whom Olmsted described, happened to own 1,000 acres of land, not one of which he tilled, and more hogs and cattle than he could count. His place was teeming with deer and other game, but he never shot any. 'Twas too much trouble. When he wanted fresh, 'twas easier to go out and stick a hog. That is the key to how the plain folk lived. In the literal sense of the phrase, they lived high off the hog. Virtually all, even those who own no land, own animals. No one actually needed to own land, for the open range prevailed throughout the South. Animals were simply branded or clipped and turned loose to graze the land, anybody's land, for fencing laws in every southern state prohibited the enclosure of any space not actually under cultivation and required farmers, those who were foolish enough to labor in the earth, to fence their crops against the animals of others rather than the other way around. When the larder got low, the plain folk stuck another hog. For vegetables, almost no tillage was necessary, since green gardens in the southern soil and climate, once planted, grew wild, reseeding themselves year after year if they were appropriately neglected, as was also the case with pumpkins, sweet potatoes, and several other vegetables. In 1854, a startled German, who found the South far different from his own culture, wrote to friends back home, "There are such fine fruits and plants here. The forest is a veritable vineyard, for grapes of all kind grow in the wild forest, as well as such things as are planted in the fine gardens of Germany. All such things grow in the woods here. You can also keep as many cows here as you wish, for feed does not cost a penny. Cattle feed themselves in the woods in winter and summer. No cattle here is fed in the barn. Grass grows 6 to 8 feet high in the woods, and one person has as much right there as another. Similarly, you can keep as many pigs as you wish, and you need not feed them. Same is true of chickens. We do not want to go on, for we can live here like lords." Once a year, in the fall, after the livestock had fattened themselves on acorns and other nuts, herds were rounded up and driven to market as a cash crop. A week or two of work in the spring, a week or two in the fall, were all that was required to keep the system going. The system made the South lavishly self-sufficient. Lavishly, that is, by the plain folks' own preferred standards, which required only an abundance of leisure, tobacco, liquor, and food. That they had the first three of these four is attested by virtually every travel account. As for food, Sam B. Hilliard has estimated in a marvelous book called Hog Meat and Hoe Cake that antebellum Southerners consumed approximately 150 pounds of pork and 50 pounds of beef per capita per year. And it is to be observed that that was lean meat. Now, that's one-third again as much animal protein per capita as was consumed by Americans in 1977. It figures out to 248 grams of animal protein per man, woman, and child per day, which is nearly five times the amount of total protein intake recommended for adult males by the Food and Nutrition Board of the National Research Council in 1978. Nor was self-sufficiency all. The value, I'm going to have to run this sentence by you twice because you've got to listen very carefully to it. The value of Southern livestock in 1860 was twice that of the year's cotton crop and approximately as much as the value of all Southern crops combined. All right? Twice as much as the cotton crop, nearly as much as all crops in this, grown in the South combined. At first, the comparison may seem inappropriate, since only about a fifth of the animals were slaughtered for market. Another three-fifths of the hogs, however, were slaughtered for home consumption, meaning that the value of the annual swine crop, so to speak, was 80% of the total value. Moreover, virtually all the gross sales of livestock was net profit, whereas the profit margins in crops was relatively slender and uncertain. The drives of Southern livestock in enormous herds over long distances were such as to boggle the imagination. The French Broad River area of East Tennessee sent more than 150,000 hogs a year across the mountains into North and South Carolina. 80,000 or more passed through Cumberland Gap each fall. Cumberland Gap used to be known as the Great Kentucky Hog Road. Another 100,000 or so came south annually along established routes from Kentucky and Tennessee to Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. This was a fantastic business. They had along the way what were honest to God called hog hotels, right? Spaced at about one day's drive of a herd of hogs of 2 or 3 or 5 or 10,000 hogs at a crack, and you came in there and people made their living, well, farmers made their living by selling corn to the hog stands or hotels, and you would put your hogs up there for the night as you marched them along. It was a very interesting business. The magnitude of the industry may be seen by comparing drives in the Old South with the more celebrated later drives during the heyday of the cowboy. My pal Grady McWinney, and partner in this venture, once wanted, in the worst way, for John Wayne to have starred as a pig boy just once before he died. Walter Prescott Webb, in his classic work, The Great Plains, provides us with a table showing the number of Texas cattle driven to market in each of the 15 years from 1866 to 1880. The average annual number was about 280,000. The total during the period, 4,200,000. By contrast, during the last 15 years of the antebellum period, Southerners drove or otherwise marketed an average of 4,468,000 hogs per year. The total during the period was 67 million. The marketing of cattle in the antebellum South is more difficult to estimate, but in 1850, a federal agency reported that for the past 20 years, one small area of the South, some 200 miles square of piney woods in southern Mississippi, eastern Louisiana, and western Alabama, had raised for market 1 million cows annually. One more important point needs to be made. The leisurely lifestyle of the southern plain folk was not a byproduct of slavery, as many contemporary travelers thought, nor was it an adaptation made by Europeans to the peculiar climatological and geographical conditions of the region. Nor, for that matter, was it a product of the frontier process. Even though the South was still frontier country in 1860, only a quarter of its land having been cleared in the 2.5 centuries since the white man began to arrive. Rather, the Southern way was a classical example of two anthropological principles, that of cultural conservatism and that of cultural pre-adaptation. The first is that a society tends to preserve its accustomed ways unless interaction with other groups or conquest or pressures of government or other forces require or induce it to change. The second is, pre-adaptation, is that cultural traits which persist despite having little or no survival value in one environment may have high survival value when transplanted to a different environment. Now, We have not yet completed our massive investigation of the ethnic origins of antebellum Americans, but our research thus far indicates that Southerners, unlike their Yankee counterparts, did not originate in Anglo-Saxon England, but in the Celtic portions of Great Britain, that is to say, in the Celtic fringe of England and in Cornwall, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland. This apparently began very early on. Charles Banks, in his study of 2,800 and something immigrants to Massachusetts, to New England between 1620 and 1650, of 2,800, he found only 185 originating in Wales or the Celtic fringe, and 2,400 or thereabouts in the south and east of England. Contrarywise, John Eacott Manahan, in a study of 7,700 references to Virginia immigrants in the 17th century, found that something like 7,400 did come from the Celtic fringe or from Wales, Cornwall, or Scotland, or wherever. Right? A polarization from the very beginning. One other thing. Look at a map sometime of the English Civil War, right? And then look at a map sometime of showing the distribution of the ancient peoples of Britain, say the year 500, 800 thereabouts, right? Celtic people, Germanic people. The maps are identical. Okay. Now, by 1790, when the first United States census was taken, the pattern of ethnic sectionalization resulting from the course of colonial migration was firmly established. In New England, well over three-quarters of the people were of English origins. New York, having originally been a Dutch colony, retained a large Dutch component in its population, but the largest single component, something over two-fifths of the people, was English. Pennsylvania was polyglot. Two-fifths of the people were of Celtic origins, a third were German, fewer than a fifth were English. Elsewhere, the further south and west from Philadelphia, the more Celtic the population. In the upper south, Celts and Englishmen each constituted about two-fifths of the population, and in the Carolinas, more than half the people were Celtic, and Celts outnumbered Englishmen 2-1. What is quite as important, Celts entirely dominated the interior from Pennsylvania southward, ranging in various areas from three-fifths to nearly 100% of the total population. The significance of this distribution lay in its effect upon migration patterns during the next six or seven decades. When New Englanders moved westward, they tended, most of them, went almost in a beeline along the Mohawk River across New York and then fanned out around the Great Lakes. The Celts filled the Ohio Valley and the Trans-Appalachian South. In between were Germans and Dutch and stragglers from the two major sources who had wandered off the track. By 1850, then, the South was three-quarters or more Celtic, New England and the upper Middle West were three-quarters or more English, and the border areas between were mixed. What's the significance of all this? Well, as J.G.A. Pocock puts it, the Celtic peoples are no more English than Britain is European. Celts and people on the Celtic frontier of England shared many cultural characteristics, the most relevant for present purposes being a long-standing tradition of open-range pastoralism and an accompanying disdain for tillage agriculture, especially for labor-intensive cultivation. As early as 1185, Gerald of Wales reported, after a tour of Ireland, that, quote, the pastoral way of life, the tending of herds, did not require the same physical toil involved in arable farming, and therefore the Irish were thought to be indolent. You will notice the striking similarity between these quotes and others. Three or four years ago, I gave a paper before the Alabama Historical Association in which all I did was put together a composite description of a people whom I did not identify, right? And I invited the audience to make their guesses. The guesses were of three sorts. One, it came from Frederick Law Olmsted in his tour of the South in the 1850s. Two, that it was taken from that masterful work by Professor Owsley, The Plain Folk of the Old South. And three, that I just made the thing up and I was describing my neighbors in Coker, Alabama. The sources I had used started with Diodorus and Strabo, ancient Greek and Roman and so on geographers, Julius Caesar, the ancient Irish legend of Cuchulainn, and going on up. The most recent source I used was Thomas Pennant's 1769 Travels Through Scotland. Okay? And everybody knew they were Southerners. Well, let me go on with Gerald of Wales. He found the same thing to be true of Wales. It must always be borne in mind that the Welsh are not being enervated by daily toil, he reported. The whole population lives almost entirely on the produce of their herds. They eat plenty of meat, but little bread. They pay no attention to commerce, shipping, or industry. This leisurely pastoral way of life perdured and remained characteristic of all the Celtic portions of the British Isles. The Exchequer rolls for 1378 show nearly 45,000 hides being exported from Scotland that year, indicating that animal husbandry was the basis of the kingdom's economy. Estienne Perlin, a mid-16th century traveler in Scotland, speaks of the abundance of cattle, a term that comprehends sheep, horses, and swine, as well as bovine animals. Later in the 16th century, according to A.R.B. Haldane in his monumental study of droving in Scotland, Bishop Leslie noted that huge herds of every manner of livestock, which, through a certain wildness of nature, forage the open range like wild harts wandering out of order. And despite some anglicization of the lowlands after the Act of Union of 1707, open range animal husbandry remained the way of life of the Scottish plain folk until well into the 18th century. Indeed, as Haldane has made clear, one main effect of the Act of Union was to open southeastern English markets for long trail drives of Scottish animals. By the way, they didn't drive just hogs and cattle and cows. They drove geese, they drove turkeys, they, 500 miles, nothing to it. As for the Scots plain folks themselves, Thomas Pennant described them pithily in 1769. They were, he said, indolent to a high degree, unless roused to war or to any animating amusement. The Celts had sometimes thrived, sometimes been impoverished, but they were amazingly resistant to changing their ways, and particularly to making the painful wrench from being animal raisers to being mere tillers of the soil. The Irish, for instance, held crop growing in such contempt that, despite centuries of oppressive English landlordism, it was not until the 1780s that planting began to be common in Ireland. And then, of course, with the potato, a crop whose labor requirements are minimal. By the way, the Scotch had introduced the potato about 100 years earlier, in the 1680s, 1690s, and the very first thing they learn about the potato is you can make vodka out of it. Thomas Croker's description of Irish peasants, written in 1824, strikingly resemble Olmsted's descriptions of Southern Americans. The cabins of the peasantry, Croker recorded, are teeming with a numerous population of children, pigs, and poultry. An adequate idea of the wretchedness of their habitations can scarcely be formed from description. The floor is bare earth, so uneven that the four legs of a chair are seldom of use at one time, and baskets and utensils lie around in an indiscriminate litter. A pig, the wealth of the Irish peasant, roams about with conscious importance. Of pork, the Irish possessed abundance and were insatiably fond. An Irish laborer has no idea of planting a bush or fruit tree or of raising a flower, and his ignorance renders him too stubborn to make trial of improved agricultural implements. When the culturally pre-adapted Celtic peoples migrated to the southern uplands of British North America, which they did on a grand scale beginning during the 100 years after 1715, they found geographical and political conditions ideal for the flourishing of their style of life. In sum, the opulently easy society of the southern plain folk on the eve of the Civil War represented the culmination of many centuries of Celtic tradition. Well, the way, as we have seen, the way of the New England Yankee, of course, became the American way and made the United States into what it was. But the blessing was not unalloyed. To appreciate what we lost in the bargain, let us return to Thomas Pennant's description of the Highlanders. For therein lies the key to the enduring quality of the Celtic slant-line Southern contributions to American life. The manners of the native Highlanders, Pennant wrote, may be justly expressed in these words: indolent to a high degree unless roused to war or to any animating amusement. They are much affected with the civility of strangers and have in themselves a natural politeness and address which often flows from the meanest when least expected. They're excessively inquisitive after your business, your name, and other particulars of little consequence to them. They have much pride and consequently are impatient of affronts and revengeful. The crucial phrase is that one I mentioned earlier, indolent and less roused. To put it the other way around, Southerners, like their Celtic ancestors, were always subject to momentary fits of enthusiasm during which they dreamed, planned, and began all sorts of grand undertakings. but they had neither the sustained psychic energy nor the patience to carry them through, so they rarely finished anything. They were always magnificent warriors, for instance, but were ever better at winning battles than at the steady, tedious business of winning wars. And as I mentioned to the people at my table at lunch, the Southern penchant for worshiping or idealizing lost causes did not begin in the 1860s. It began in 225 B.C., when the Celts, having been defeated for the first time by the Romans, joined up with Hannibal. And they've done it ever since. Intimately related to this quality of not having the patience to carry things through was another quality, and that is the tendency of Southerners toward extremes. I just love getting together with a bunch of Yankees at a group like this, and people ask me, is the South going to go conservative? The South isn't conservative, never has been. South vacillates between being crazy radical populist and between either totally lethargic about politics or reactionary, right? I mean, the polls are reaction and crazies. Well, crazies on either end. You know, politics in America is always, to some extent anyway, political elections are, political campaigns, a ritual substitute for war. And if it were thoroughly Celticized, we would be seeing a lot more of the real thing. Okay. This is scarcely the stuff of which great empires are made, and no Celtic society ever made one. But the Celtic Southern way has had two redeeming virtues. One is that if someone else will supply the discipline and constancy, Celts can achieve mightily, as British history has abundantly shown. Under the plodding, unimaginative rule of England, the Welsh proved a virtually endless wellspring of poets and playwrights, of actors and musicians. And the Scots, for more than two centuries, kept the United Kingdom abundantly supplied not only with its best fighting men, but also with its most brilliant philosophers, physicians, scientists, and engineers. The Celtic contribution in America has been no less profound. The other virtue may be more valuable. We're finally beginning to realize that modern industrial civilization, for all of its material benefits, was purchased at a staggering cost in the form of alienation, depersonalization, regimentation, and bureaucratization. Now, Southerners knew that all along. They resisted the building of such a civilization in America and continued to be ill-fitting members of it. And in their traditional lifestyle, there's a lesson that others might profit by learning, a lesson having to do with not taking oneself too seriously and with orienting one's life toward leisure rather than toward achievement. Perhaps, after all, it is better to go hunting and fishing than to work 9 to 5 in an office or factory. Perhaps it is more important to visit and talk with friends and family than to chase the almighty dollar. Perhaps it is more rewarding to know the joys of dreaming and bragging than to know the frustration and heartache of attempting to accomplish. As a 20th century American, I've been conditioned to believe otherwise. But as a born and bred Celtic Southerner, I suspect I'm wrong. Thank you. Thank you very much. As an encore, I brought along here a paper on the natural law origins of the Declaration of Independence.